Welcome to Talk Recovery Radio, coming to you live every Thursday. If you're listening to us right now on 100.5 FM, then you are listening to last week's show because it takes a week to update. So thanks for listening to us live on the radio. We'll be back in the studio, hopefully, in phase four of COVID-19. It's just all those microphones and little viruses that we're not allowed in there. We've been trying this Facebook Live thing for a while, and it's been working for us, so we're excited. You can catch us on iTunes, SoundCloud, and YouTube. All of our replay shows are talkrecoveryradio.com. So thanks for listening to our show. And every week, we try to bring you a guest that is an expert on addiction recovery. Hey, Darren, hello. Welcome back to the show. Oh no, Darren. Oh no. Something must have happened to your computer. Yeah.
That happens to mine once in a while, and I have to reload Zoom.
Do you want to do sign language? I can get Matt in here. He's our sign language. So, Darren, the only thing I can suggest is I don't even know if I've got telephone numbers for this meeting. Let me take a look. You can jump on your phone. There's no phone numbers.
Okay, Chuck.
Oh, there you are. Hello.
Hi.
I'm present. All right.
All right.
Wow, that scared me. I didn't know what I was going to do.
Okay, all right, okay.
So you hold up little signs. You know how they do when they pull the cards?
Yeah.
I would have read them for you.
Questions.
Right.
I don't even know why I'm wearing these anymore. Okay, I'm going to go back into my headphones because I thought maybe it was me. Okay, now you don't wear anything off the back. Okay, Darren, you take it over. We'll talk
about just.
Yeah, you take over. We'll talk about Recovery Month at the end of the show, everybody. So stick around for the end of the show so we can talk about what's going on with Recovery Month Canada. Darren, who are we talking with Recovery today?
We get to talk with Donna Spear today. Is that how you pronounce your last name?
That is.
Spear, okay. Yeah. S-P-E-I-R. Author, model actress turned recovery coach and interventionist.
Mm-hmm.
You have a book called The Naked Truth, The Fall and Rise of Donna Spear. This is pretty cool. You're a history of model, actress, seven of Andy Sedaris action adventure movies.
Right on.
I'm a busy girl.
If anybody knows the genre, I mean, these are cult classics. This is a big story. A young relationship with Bill Cosby, Playboy centerfold. This is sort of that Hollywood dream lifestyle for a lot of women, that are looking to make it in that sort of international, global market of modeling and acting and whatnot. Was it worth it?
So there's kind of two parts to my story. Okay. Yeah. So one of the things people forget is I got sober really young. Mm. I got sober at 23.
Yeah.
So I've been sober 33 years now. So in the middle of all that insanity, I got sober. So I did a lot of that really bad acting in those bad movies sober. So let's face it, I'm not a real actress. I mean, I'm an actress. I was an actress. I just really can't act. Okay. Yeah. So the early years of my modeling, it was bad.
Yeah.
It was bad. So if you read my book, one of the things is that I never wanted to be a model. I was born an addict alcoholic, obviously. And I didn't have that ability to follow my dreams. I was one of those people who just rolled into opportunities. Like most people, most addicts, we just kind of end up where we are, right? And because of the way I looked, and I didn't have a lot of guidance at home because my parents were a lot older and I was the youngest of six kids, I just kind of rolled into that model role. You know, in my book, I deal with a lot of sexual abuse from other people. Cosby just happened to be one of those people as I was underage.
Okay.
Right. By the time I got sober, that chapter was over in my life. And that's when I had to deal with that, because that's a lot of the reason, not the reason, but part of the reason in early years. I mean, I was 16 years old, 15 years old. I mean, I was a baby girl. When I met Cosby, I wasn't even old enough to drive. And he was 42. So that was a 26 years difference.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, how did you do it then? How did you get sober in all of that? Where most of the typical story is getting out of the lifestyle.
Right.
How did you get sober in that?
So the first time I got sober, I was 18 years old. And this was before the Betty Fords and all the rehab. So it wasn't like real accessible, you know. And the first time I got sober, even though I was drinking real heavily, I was smoking crack. And it wasn't even called crack back then. It was called freebasing. This was back in the Richard Pryor era. This is back on those times when, like, if you smoked freebase, you were a junkie. And back then it was like being a junkie was the bottom of the barrel. I mean, nowadays everybody does heroin. Everybody's on opioids. You know what I mean? It's an epidemic that's just killing people left and right. But back then it's like, you didn't tell people you were doing that. But I, you know, being the addict that I am, you know, as soon as I took my first hit, it was like more in the carpet, more, you know? Because that's the way I am. That's a drug addict I am. And so the first time I got sober, I was 18 years old and my parents grabbed me and threw me into a treatment facility, which got me off of drugs, but I didn't believe I was an alcoholic.
Okay.
So what that did was, as soon as I got some weight back on, I went back into the modeling profession. And that's when I did Playboy and started a role again. Unfortunately, I didn't stay sober. I only stayed sober a year. And I started drinking. But I knew if I picked up cocaine and crack, it was going to kill me.
Okay.
So for 3.5 years, I drank. And then I came back at 23 and I knew I was alcoholic. I knew to my innermost self.
How long were you able to manage drinking out of rehab?
If you want to call it manage?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So it took me from the time I picked up a drink until I crawled back in the rooms, 3.5 years.
Okay.
So, but I did a lot of damage in those 3.5 years. I mean, a lot of damage. So by the time I got back at 23, I was on my second and a half marriage, you know, because I like to get married. Two in the United States, one in Mexico, which I'm probably still married there. I'm busy, man. When I drink, I'm a busy girl. I love, you know, I say yes to everything. I'm like, you want a party? Yeah, let's go. I'm a happy drunk. What?
Absolutely. It's Mexico. That's what people do.
Olé. You know?
We know a few people that have gotten married in Mexico, and what happens in Mexico sadly doesn't stay in Mexico. It usually follows you back home. I have a question. So you're brand new in recovery, and I mean, recovery's changed in the last 32 years. I think today, you know, not only are people more open about their drug use, but people are now not anonymous anymore. And with the whole recovery movement and stuff, and, you know, let's recover out loud.
Right.
So 32 years ago, you're young, mm-hmm. You know, most people have no idea what Alcoholics Anonymous is or Narcotics Anonymous is or recovery. Mm-hmm. And here you are showing up at Playboy. Like, did people support you? Was it hush hush? Nobody knew. What was that like?
It was being really different. First of all, like back then, I was really young in the rooms, so it was really weird. And then, so I go to Playboy, and I mean, just going to the Playboy Mansion or anything like that, and having an agent. So I didn't tell a lot of people, but they noticed. See, I was like the cool girl, and then all of a sudden I was the cool girl who didn't drink or do drugs, and they were kind of like, you know, what's up?
What's wrong with you?
The other centerfolds, because we used to travel together and work together, and all of a sudden they're kind of like, we don't trust you. You know, so that I'll be chatting and they'd see me walk in and they'd like, it was like I had the plague and they'd herd together over there. So it was really difficult. It was really difficult for me for quite a while. In fact, I write about that in my book, how I became a social outcast almost. But then I went to my agent and told him, you know, I said, look, I'm sober. I'm sober. And if anybody needs help, you can send them to me.
Wow.
Yeah, you know, because what am I going to do?
That's pretty cool that that idea, that philosophy came to you in that, you know, rather than just being the most important thing, keeping a secret, you know, or not telling anybody in that way, that was your approach, because you don't often hear that approach so soon in that type of environment where...
You know, back then, you know, the whole thing of sobriety was totally different back then. Man, I got sober by a group of women who were tough, man. They were mean. They were mean. And that they, when they suggested something, you did it. You never called them back by not doing it. Today it's like, oh, honey, I'm so glad. What do you feel? How are you feeling? Yeah. It'll be okay. No, it wasn't like that back then. It's like, Donna, you do this and call me back when it's done. Click.
Right. Like, you better help some people.
You want to stay sober and you want to get a life back so you don't die? I suggest you do this. And they were right.
And how was it for your career in that sense? I mean, you hear, you know, the story of the pressures, you know, in that environment, like needing to excel their talents and that sort of thing, and just get comfortable by, you know, taking a little bit of the edge off.
You know, that's nonsense. That is nonsense. It's any business, you have pressures. That is the biggest piece of BS I've ever heard. Any business, any relationship, whatever you're doing, you have pressures. If you're going to drink, you're going to drink. You know, back then we used to say a slip is something you wear under a dress. A drink or a drug is a premeditated drink, period.
No doubt.
Right? So if you're going to go out and get high, you're going to get high. I don't care what business you're in. You know, for me, what happened was I became responsible. And once I became responsible, I started landing some pretty big jobs.
Right. Because you were accountable, you're responsible, people could count on you to...
Yep.
I mean, you often hear it, you know, especially, you know, those with talents that think they become more creative under the influence, and if they had ever quit, they would lose that. And those that survive it, though, and end up getting sober, you hear time and time again, I've never been more creative. My talents have just excelled. And I mean, I guess you got to be in something for some, you know, in somebody that's in recovery to know that, to really feel that. So would you say, you know, pursue your goals, pursue your careers? Would you say hold off, get well and get good at being sober? What's your opinion on that?
If you're a drug addict alcoholic like me and you don't get sober, chances are you're going to die. And you're going to die alone. So, I mean, I'm straightforward. If you read my book, I don't hold anything back. Okay. I work with a lot of girls and I'm straight up. Whether you want to be creative or you want to sit by yourself in a house, whatever you decide to do, if you don't get sober and you're a drug addict, alcoholic, chances are you're going to die alone. I buried a lot of my friends. Mm-hmm. No, we all have. So, you know, I don't care how you do it. I don't care how you get sober. Chances are treatment will probably help you to get a little boost there. But whatever it is, if you've got a problem with drugs or alcohol, what I know is, for me, I couldn't do it alone.
Yeah.
And then all the rest of the good stuff came. So I can't sit around and get creative loaded because I can't do anything. I can't get out of my house when I'm loaded. I can't get out of the closet.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just my truth. That was who I was.
So yeah. we're talking with Donna Spear. She's the author of The Naked Truth, The Fall and Rise of Donna Spear, Playboy model, victim of Bill Cosby. You're listening to us on 100.5 FM, Vancouver Co-op Radio. Thanks for listening, everyone. So Donna, you wrote this book. It's a memoir of your stories. You know, what inspired you to write the book? And what do you want people to get out of it? Is it like a guide to sobriety? Is it here's all my stuff? What do you want someone to do after they're done?
So no, it's not a guide to sobriety. I don't have a market on sobriety whatsoever. I think people have to find their own path. And nowadays, you know, I used to be really closed-minded. I got sober a long time ago and there was one path for me, right? Nowadays, there's all these other paths. I don't know what's best for you. I really don't, right? Yeah. I'm a coach and I help people find what works best for you, right? My book was written, a lot of people have suggested I share my story. And so finally, I sat down with a gentleman by the name of Chris Epstein, who's a very well-known author. He has written over 30 books. I caught him in between. He had just finished writing John Oates from Hall & Oates memoir in between. And now he's finishing up the Doobie Brothers 50th anniversary memoirs, the two guys. So he's a pretty big author, right? And yeah. I don't know how he squeaked me in there, but he did. And so, you know, I wrote it because A, I could. And B, because I think it's really important for women to understand that they don't have to carry the shame and guilt around and die between all that stuff inside and use and drink behind it. And that it's real toxic. And so I just laid it all out there. I mean, a lot of people look at me and go, you know, Donna, you have such a perfect lifestyle and you're so pretty and you have this and that. But if they really knew what I walked through, that they would say they could too. And so I really needed to open up and share about what my journey really looked like.
And in the, you know, the title, The Naked Truth, what, excuse me, what is the truth? Like, I mean, is it sort of to reveal, you know, secrets that we're carrying? Is it just to tell somebody your story?
It is raw.
Yeah.
It's like, I don't hold back. I mean, people are like, if you read some of the reviews on Amazon, they're like, this woman does not hold back. So I own it. There's no blame in anybody here. You know, honestly, I was a sexual victim when I was young, right? But had I not been drinking and using, I wouldn't have got myself in some of those situations I got myself in. I mean, and that's the truth. I can't blame that on anybody, you know? You know, this is funny. So here's the deal, right? Here's the deal. So you ready for this? You ready?
Oh, yeah.
In the closet, the sharp asterisk aroma of my Bernic acrylic fingernails made my eyes water, or maybe I was crying. My hands were charred with dozens of burn marks, nails burned down to the nubs. My tongue was raw and bleeding and was still painful from the smoke in the last week. I was disintegrating. Right? My ears, deep ringing, that always happened. I freebased. I remember the, and it just goes on. I had overdosed on massive amounts of Quaaludes and other narcotics a bunch of times in my life already, but this was different. I felt like the bitter and brutaling. I was ready to die in that squalid little closet. The entire cooking up process with this devil dust, the smoke, blah, 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 the smoke of the pipe enveloped me in the closet, forming an evil, suffocating haze, coupled with the fire from the small butane blowtorch that I kept furiously firing up. I created my own little raging private hell. So the walls started tightening around me. Was this the end? That's how I opened the book.
You know, that's addiction. I mean, that's drug use. That's hell. That is, you know, all of the things that we're not hearing you know, when it comes to new policies, when it comes to addiction. And like, there's no amount of safe narcotics. Mm-mm. Like if you would have had, you know, and I'm not against safe supply, but I'm just about this conversation. If you were given safe supply back then, a prescription drug, like, but like, what about you on the
an hour?
I mean, if anything, you had the purest of pure back then. I remember doing cocaine in the 90s. Like, it was pretty good stuff. Like, it was pure, like prescription grade. And there was never enough. And like the psychosis and like, I know about what you mean about the closet and like. Like, this is what we need to hear. This is what addiction is. Like, if you can, you know, like they say in the big book, if you can have a glass of wine and be a gentleman, like, our hats are off to you. It's just like, enjoy it. But like, this is the real stuff. Are you fearful? You know, thank you for writing an honest book about addiction. Are you fearful that it's going to be difficult being a recovery coach, especially in the States with this whole conversation about meet people where they're at, you know, like it's not their fault for doing drugs. We just need to give them, you know, a safe space to do prescription grade drugs and everything will be fine.
I'm like, straight up, man. I don't pull punches. Well, first of all, I'm not a doctor.
Yeah.
Okay? I make that really clear. And if you go to AA, our book says we only know a little.
Yeah.
Right. So I'm not an MD. I'm not going to tell you quit taking your meds.
Yeah.
But I'm going to say, how well are they working for you?
Yeah.
How well are they working for you? You taking that trazodone? How well is that working for you? Really? Okay. Let's talk about it. You know, or whatever you're taking, you know. But I don't know what's best for you.
Mm-hmm.
I'm old school. All I know is what worked for me, but there's other theories of thought. And I had, when I went through classes, I had to learn about that. I don't know about the safe supply. That you don't give an addict safe. There is no such thing as safe supply for an addict. Now, you may have to taper them off and detox them, which I thoroughly believe. And I believe detox should, depending upon the person, it should be done in a safe environment, right? But, and then we have the whole, you know, we have the whole thing with the, I'm just lost my, not the heroin, but the opioid epidemic, which is a whole nother ball of wax because it changes the chemicals in your brain, right? And that is a whole nother thing that we didn't deal with back then. But, you know.
Yeah. I was just talking to somebody the other day, you know, more money than you could spend in 10 lifetimes. And, you know, his DOC is alcohol and he's sitting in his multi-million dollar home and he's just crying by himself, no family, no friends, just wanting to stop drinking. And he's just ready to end his life. And it's kind of one of those things. It's just like, should we give him a safe supply of vodka? Cause he's already got lots of, you know what I mean? It's just that whole, you know, and for him to even start a recovery journey, like, I mean, it's such a complicated world. And I hope people listening, like, just really look at the bigger picture. It's just like, you know, this guy, there's no easy access to like a government healthcare system. It's like, you know, if you got money, you're gonna get recovery coaches and everything. So tell me about recovery coaching.
Okay,
so
I'm gonna back you up there a little bit. So
sure,
we talk about the money issue, right?
Yeah. Okay.
So see, when I in the book, when I was 19 years sober and I was living in Newport Beach, I was a single mom, and there's an issue about that money thing, right? And I had a ton of money in sobriety. I was married and we had yachts, we had blah, 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 boats and planes, trains and automobiles, right? And I was working with women, and in Newport Beach, I saw there was a need for a place for women to go who didn't have insurance, even in this wealthy community, okay? So I started a women's place that didn't need insurance and it didn't need funding. 30 days treatment. We housed, clothed, and gave them shelter and food. So there are resources. And to this day, that house has had over 2,500 women. So I don't
That's find amazing.
Our resources out there. You just have to want it.
And unfortunately, people like yourself, individuals that you know, are advocating for more than what the governments are providing to start these things. I mean, this should be something across the board for anybody to be able to access. Mm-hmm. And that's the struggle we're getting, we're finding up here in Canada as well. So is Lynn House still functioning, still going?
Lynn House is still functioning. It's in Costa Mesa, California. I have no part of it. I made it like a rotating committee, like General Service and Alcoholics Anonymous in New York, and World Service, I mean, and they have a rotating committee. And you know what? I think they have 6 beds for free that rotates them in and out. And you just go in and you stay there for 30 days.
That's great. Yeah. You know, it's interesting. We get through COVID in every city across the US and Canada, including here in Vancouver. You know, they turn convention centers into hospitals and ready to, like, you know, deal with the sick. And yet, you know, thousands upon thousands of people have died because of overdoses and addiction too. You don't see emergency treatment centers being opened up across cities, you know, just come in today and we'll help you, you know, with your recovery journey, whatever that looks like. And there's just not the same response. And I don't know why people aren't in an uproar about that. It's just, you know, our convention center right now in Vancouver is empty, with all these hospital beds, been waiting for, you know, the rise in COVID, but it never happened. I'm like, why didn't they turn it into an addiction recovery place so people can not just get housing, but get, you know, recovery services with psychiatrists and doctors? But I guess just the wrong people are dying, you know, right now. And hopefully that changes more. So this is something that a lot of people try. Some do successfully and some do very miserably because they're in recovery, but I don't know whatever the status of recovery is, but they think, you know, I've got something to give that's a bit more than just sponsorship or giving back. I'm going to start this business. So how did you go through the process of, you know, being a person in recovery with a great story and then you know, going into the business of recovery and recovery coaching? What was that transition, balance, making sure your recovery and your side of the fence is okay? And what are some tips for people out there who are thinking about doing it? Because it seems like everybody at some point, it's like, I'm going to create a website and, you know, do all this.
I've had 12 minutes sober. I'm going to open a recovery home and I'm going to do this and I'm going
to do that.
I get that. And I see it all the time. I see it on Instagram. So I have been, everybody and their brother has come to me about opening recovery homes. I live in Silicon Valley right now. And I have had Silicon Valley VCs come to me and let's give you all this money and open up recovery homes and let's make a mint on these people and let's do this. And that's just not my gig because I am not one for recovery for profit. You know, you know, and I'll be honest with you, you know what? I still sponsor a handful of girls. I'm a hands-on sponsor. I meet them every Monday night. And when we can't meet, we meet online. I still talk to my sponsor. I see her at a meeting once a week. I call her like 3 times a week. I go to book studies. Look, I have a solid program. I don't screw around with my sobriety. That comes first. Recovery coaching came about, because I was a sober companion, and a sober companion I got involved in that because there was a demand because of my entertainment background. And that's the only reason I got called in as a sober companion. And what a sober companion, I don't know if you guys are familiar what they are.
But for our listeners, maybe you can let them know.
Okay, so people who are either high net worth people or who are in the entertainment business or easily recognizable, after going through 30 days of treatment, instead of going to a secondary living environment, they will be called to have someone come and move in with them. And then I get to babysit them. Women.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Tell us some stories. No, I'm kidding.
I have not taken a job in years because it is, people think, oh, it's so glamorous and it's wonderful, make so much money. No, it's like living with a newcomer 24/7 in a zoo.
Yeah.
Families go, fix them. They're this, fix them. It's like, I can't fix. No human power can relieve their alcoholism. Mm-hmm. And they're crazy. And they have too much money. And most of them have never made their own beds. And most of them have never fried an egg. And they don't like to be told what to do.
Yeah.
You know? And so actually myself and Catherine, who is my business partner, if you go to my website, donnaspear.com, we still do companion work. Catherine does a lot more than I do, because I'm busy doing other things, but that's what I did. And so instead of doing that all the time, because my last client I worked with just about killed me. And unfortunately, you know, like she ended up dying. So, stopped a couple of years ago, and I decided, you know, maybe I could be a little more useful as a coach. And so I stopped and I wrote a book, and I went and I got certified as a coach. And, you know, I can't say I do a ton of coaching, but I have a lot of people I coach, and it's different than working the 12 steps. Some of them are sober. Most of them are sober. I have to be very careful. I don't do 12 steps, but I do encourage. I'm like your cheerleader, your hard person. I guide them into positive actions. You know, because like me as a sponsor, I go by the book. I teach, you know, I'm on them about meetings, calling other women, showing up on time, sitting in the front of the room, getting a commitment, doing things that I do, going to book studies, things like that, working with newcomers. But as a coach, those aren't the things I teach you. You know, what time do you get up? What do you mean you're going to bed at 1:30 watching Netflix? Of course you're not productive. What do you think? Duh. but we set goals and we move forward in life, because a lot of people get stuck. And I coach people also in long-term sobriety who are really stuck in their lives.
When we need a reboot and re-engage, which is something that everybody misses the mark. It's like everybody, which we should be focusing on people that are still using and going through the detox process. But we need a healthcare system that also builds on the recovery coaching world. It's just like, how are you doing on a yearly basis and so forth? And you know, where's your recovery capital in your life today? You're 1 year clean, 2 years clean, 5 years clean. Like, you know, what's going on for you as a preventative tool, so you don't end up in a place where it's like you're already in the tornado.
You know, I talk about it, 3.5 years sober, I ended up suicidal and I got locked down, you know, without my shoelaces and, you know, lighter, you know, and I'm in 30 day nut ward. I'm standing there. I've got a nurse lighting my cigarette, right? And I'm on the phone with the girls I sponsor. I'm like, so if you want what I have, I don't even have a belt. So, you know, there are things that come up, because just because we get sober, we're still in real life. And it doesn't mean we have all the tools. And you're right about our healthcare system. To talk about what you were saying about the convention center with the beds, a lot of people are misinformed that they don't understand that drug and alcohol abuse is about willpower. Why don't they just stop? My sister, Donna, why don't you just stop? Why don't you just stop that? Stop that. Stop using those drugs. Quit getting married. You know, stop getting married. I'm like, I can't.
Yeah.
You know, I'm addicted to relationships. I smoke and I drink and I do these things, and then I show up and walk down the aisle, you know, because it seemed like the next indicated thing to do. You know, I'm crazy.
And unfortunately, the people that don't understand the willpower, you know, idea sort of create this more victimization. Oh, well, they don't have choices, and so we just need to keep them from dying. And that's where the harm reductions just gets forced in there. And it's really unfortunate, because people like us, I mean, I'm avid 12-step program.
Mm-hmm.
And yet that it's never been my philosophy that anybody I'm helping has to do that, unless they're already in the room.
Right.
And yet, just as underneath your recovery coach, we use the word recovery. That isn't about what you do specifically in your life. And a lot of people get lost in that language, that when Giuseppe and I are talking about recovery, they just assume or go right to the fact that we're talking about 12 steps only and
right. put
our agenda or our story
right.
as the only thing that works, which we have to, like, you know, subtitle every single time we, and I say it almost every show, that recovery is that area in which all options exist mm-hmm. and any forms. And, you know, whether it's just simply lifestyle coaching or whatever, the idea that that individual is doing better than he was yesterday. That's it.
Yeah.
Whether it's starting with somebody to just cut them down and get them to take a look at where their problem lies in their using or their drinking and continue on from there. Like you said, how they're sleeping, what they're eating, and so on and so forth.
Not working for you, and what are you recovering from? Well, let's look at some of these patterns that are no longer working for you. Mm-hmm.
And so many times medication is required and
we
can refer them on. And
absolutely.
You know, absolutely. Nutritionists, going to the gym, you know, mental health psychologists where, hey, I'm not a doctor. I'm not, you know, you need to see somebody. And we become the best form of healthcare wherever we are.
Yep.
And yet we seem to not have the ears of those that can create these policies. You mentioned people wanting to make the money and you help them do that. And you no way I'm not for profit. Do you have any politicians and people like that calling your phone and going, what do we need to do in our area?
Nope. No, but I know for me, what I do is I do take on a lot of pro bono people because that's just what we have to do. Yeah. And if it's just one person at a time, that's my role in the world. It's just that simple. That's just my role.
Yeah. And it's led you to receiving Woman of the Year for your work in the Yellowstone Foundation. Mm-hmm. You were on the board of Women in Need. WIN Foundation, and now currently CEO of Recovery Coaching Experts, nationally certified recovery coach and interventionist. Mm-hmm. And I mean, despite the story and the cool stories that are there, the Hollywood and all of that, I appreciate when a human being just does what they know they can do. And doesn't get caught up in the profit part. And yeah. I think we need more people like you. I mean, that's just.
You know,
doesn't sugarcoat addiction and, you know, turn it into, you know, everybody else's fault. It's like taking ownership and so forth. I wanted to ask though, we try to keep our show about addiction recovery issues. Mm-hmm. Hence the name, but there's such a huge story here that I hope we can ask a quick question about, and that's the whole Bill Cosby and sexual predators, because it's part of the book. There's a story in there and so forth, and you know, what really got me intrigued to want to ask is the you know the book has a story about helping prevent possibly your child from participating in this. So can you touch base on that? Like, I've only know about this issue because of Facebook, you know, watching all the tags and the chatter on Twitter and Facebook, but like you went through it. You're one of them. And from what I understand, you were in recovery when this happened.
No.
So you were using. Okay. All right. Perfect. Okay.
That's okay.
So what, like, how did you, did you show up in your step four and be like, you don't understand, like, this is what this guy did to me. I can never, like, how did you persevere and triumph through that?
So I got a lot of outside help.
Okay.
A lot of outside help because I needed it. It was so you know, when you're young and 15 years old, a girl, and 16 years old,
okay,
you think you're an adult.
Yeah, I remember. Yeah.
Okay, you think you know everything.
Yeah.
So, just to let you guys know, I never would have came out with this had my parents been alive. Mm-hmm. Because grooming, and this is, I think, one of the things I'm going to talk about, grooming, and this is what it was, grooming is a family business. So most sexual predators know the family. They aren't the guy that drives up, now don't get me wrong, they are the guy who drives up the street and nabs a child. But generally, someone who sexually abuses a child is someone that knows the family, is within the family, or lives in the vicinity of the family. He's your Boy Scout leader. He's your uncle. He's your neighbor. Guy who lives across the street. He is someone who's been in your home, has been around the family, been around the siblings, and been around your parents. Isn't that interesting? He has got to get the trust of the family to get close to your child. And that is what Bill Cosby did. I don't know if you guys saw that show. I think it was on Showtime or HBO with Michael Jackson and the kids. Mm-hmm. I forget what it was called. And how Michael Jackson flew around the family. Did you guys see how Michael Jackson flew the families around and gave them money and did all that? That's exactly what Bill Cosby did to my family when I was a child. He knew my parents. He put them up in elaborate hotels and my sisters. And when my sister couldn't have a baby, he sent her flowers. He gave me elaborate gifts. And everybody says, Donna, how could your parents not have known? How could your parents not have known? My parents didn't know. First of all, they were older. You got to remember. So I was the youngest of six. And my parents were like 35, 36 when they had me. But back in the late 70s, why would a man in his 40s, an African-American man in his 40s, have a sexual affair with a girl who was 16. Yeah. Why would you even think that? He was America's dad. He was a international spokesman for Coca-Cola. He was a father of six children, very well known with Camilla. Why would you even suspect that?
Did you have that exact same thinking as well? Like,
no.
Why would this be wrong? Did you know it was?
I had gotten
right away.
From one predator that I had broke from that had literally stalked me. And I was grateful to get away from him and went right into the hands of another. Mm. I literally ran. And as I was running, I ran right into his hands.
So I want to get into the recovery part now.
Sure.
So now you're, you know, you're in your 20s and, you know, you're starting a recovery journey, a very common story, sadly, for a lot of people that are using substances, there's sexual abuse in there. And there's two different stories. There's one of, you know, I'm going to get through this. And one is you don't understand, like, I can never forgive. I can never move forward. So like, how did you, with outside help, you know, how did that happen for you? Did you forget away? Did it take years?
It did take years. Okay. It took years before I even was able to separate his stuff from my stuff because there's a lot of shame involved in there. See, because I still have the mentality that I'm 15. So I protected him for a lot of years. I protected him because in my mind, he was good to me. Because he took me places and bought me things and I didn't understand what love was. So he was my rescuer. And then this is when I started really, really getting into it. So I'd gone to therapy a lot and all this, and I really worked through a lot of these issues, but still in the back of my mind, I'm like, oh no, don't, can't, no, that's Bill, don't touch him. But then I started separating it. And you have to understand, I didn't know about all the other victims. And it really, I'll be honest, it wasn't really with Bill, the other man who abused me, I had dealt with, but with Bill, it wasn't until I really started writing my book again.
Oh wow, that's many years later. Yeah,
he was going to court. He was in court, and I gotta tell you, I did not, my family didn't even know until he was put in jail. My siblings didn't. I kept that a secret. I'd gone to therapy and talked it out and shared with it and all that, but I wasn't ready to share about it until the day he was literally put in handcuffs. And then I came out with a article on Medium. Are you familiar with Medium? Written by the author of my book, and we came out with it. And the funny thing was, I wasn't even going to put that in my book.
Oh, wow.
Well, it's so important, because like you say, I mean, this is going to happen for young women. Mm-hmm. And I mean, for young kids, mm-hmm. forever.
Right.
And they're going to face, whether it's a celebrity, and if I tell the truth, I am not going to be believed.
Right.
Or if it's, like you say, the uncle or the neighbor, right. there's still a potential of the adult getting the belief and the benefit of the doubt before some young child. When looking back in hindsight, like if you're trying to, you know, send a message to a young kid, when do they come out? When do they say something? What should that look like?
So
that's way possible.
Grooming is they're sneaky. Now look, I'll be real honest with you. I had no idea I would be this advocate on sexual abuse and grooming. The book was written about recovery. I just happened to write my story and everybody wanted to talk about grooming and sexual abuse. I'm like, really? Mm. But that's where I was taken to. And it's okay, because that's what people want to hear about and they need to hear about. And I guess I can talk about it because I don't carry the shame load about it anymore. So they need to hear about it early on, because they're sneaky. It happens by a little touch. And so with the photographer before Bill, he started by like touching my shoulders and adjusting to me. And so I got used to his touch. You know, a grown man shouldn't touch a child. A grown man has no business touching a 13, 14-year-old girl, ever. Mm-hmm. Some men do not touch children. They just there's a boundary there. And then he's buying clothes for me to model it. See, and he's like doing little things like that. And it's very, very, very slow. And that's the grooming process. And I talk about how that happened in my book. So, I mean, there's more to it than I could really get into explaining. It's very, very, very slow. And then he showed me some interesting, beautiful, naked pictures of women. So he desensitized me on nudity. See, so it's really slow and freaking sneaky. They're sneaky. It's crazy. It's crazy.
Well, we're glad that you made it through that ordeal. And thank you for the courage to write a book that focuses on the journey and getting outside help just getting help. It's important, whether it's, you know, like Darren said earlier, like pick a pathway and try it. And if it works, it works. And if not, try something else. And I mean, that's what I did with drugs. I did this drug and then I did that drug and then I did this drug. So like all of a sudden I get into like, you know, recovery and it's like, you know, I'm picky. I was never picky before. You know, we got a couple minutes left. I just want to remind our viewers, Recovery Month and our listeners, Recovery Month Canada, it's a big deal. It's Motion M40. You know, I'm one on the committee and we're trying to get every member of parliament in Canada to vote yes on Motion M40 to make September officially Recovery Month. And the definition of recovery is your definition. There isn't one. This is simply to raise awareness that the recovery is possible and attainable. You know, 175 people died in June just in BC alone. That's not even the rest of Canada. So those are some pretty big numbers. And the month before was 170 in BC. So we need to share hope. And this is just the first step on raising the profile of recovery in Canada. Hopefully one day it will be just like Pride Month. you know, monuments across the country will be lit up in purple and purple flags. And it's just the beginning. We just found that in healthcare, we're not talking about recovery like we are in COVID. We're just talking about the substance use. So all you have to do is go to recoverymonthcanada.ca, put your name, put your zip code, hit send, and it automatically sends an email to your member of parliament according to your postal code. And every MP has been contacted, but the more contacts they get, the more interesting it is for them to be like, hey, I should read this. And we are hoping to get it passed Motion M40 before this September, but we need your help. You need to contact your MP. And if you're buddy-buddy with your MP, give them a call and say, hey, support Motion M40. I'm your constituent. So
Call, email, show up at their door.
Do all that. So,
well, faxes are out, but just
fax. Yeah, do it all. Do it all. So I just wanted to get that soundbite out there before the end of the show. We got a few minutes left. So now what? You got a book. You've got, you know, sponsees. You've got this, what's, you know, it looks like great opportunity, great life. You know, there's more.
You know, right now I write a column for Recovery Today magazine.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so I do that monthly. People send me questions and I answer them. You can send me a question on my Instagram site, DonnaSpear_recovery. And so I write an article every month and that's kind of fun. You know, I mean, you know, I just, whatever, you know, I've been blessed beyond years. I should have been dead years ago. So, you know, every day's a bonus. Everything's a bonus. You know, it's just, I'm happy. I'm happy. I'm married. I've got a great son. I live a great life. I'm getting ready to move to Arizona. You know, what more could I ask for? I'm looking forward to go to Arizona. You know, I look at it this way. You know, I my husband's retired. I'm getting older. I'm getting up there. And so I just know my time is done here in Silicon Valley. There's something I need to be taught in Arizona. There's a message I'm supposed to bring to some women out there. And, you know, I'm just looking forward for my life to unfold in Arizona right now.
How was it writing all of this book, all of your memoirs, and with the son at some point potentially reading it himself? Does he already know? A lot of parents out here want to protect the kids from, you know, their own story, which in my personal opinion I think is counterproductive. Obviously not every detail, but a parent's life is important to a child's upbringing of I believe. So what was, does he know it all?
My son's never seen me drink. So, you know, in that movie, so I retired from the industry before my son was born. And I think I've been in front of a camera twice since then. So this, I took time off of everything and raised him. Unfortunately, I was a single mom and it was just him and I. I mean, we're buds to the end. We skateboard together and, you know, we're like buds. He's 25 and he's an amazing young man, amazing. I mean, some days I look at him and go, God, you should sponsor me. You know, he's just as incredible. He's smart and he's funny. And he's like, he just trips me. I'm like, are you really my son? I mean, I just went back to school a couple of years ago and graduated high school because I dropped out, you know, and he's gone through college. He's got like a grown-up job. I'm like, how'd this happen? You know, I'm like, really? So he's never read it. He's never seen any of my movies, you know, he's just this great, balanced, amazing young, he's a man. It just blows my mind. Like, how'd that happen?
So happy for you. Again, we've been talking with Donna Spear. The book is The Naked Truth, The Fall and Rise of Donna Spear. You can get her Instagram, Facebook links on our page, as well as DonnaSpear.com is your website, DonnaSpear.com. Thank you so much for talking with us today on Talk Recovery.
Thank you guys for having me. What a special treat. I'm very grateful. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Do for you in the future, you let me know and I'm here. Okay, guys?
Keep helping people and let's just keep it going. Keep the message of hope alive. That's all we can do and that's our calling. Darren, great show. A little bit of a slipper at the beginning, but thank God we got you on air. It's been a wonderful show. RecoveryMonthCanada.ca. Please go there and get your form sent to your MP. Darren, have yourself a great weekend.
You too.
All right. Thanks for listening, everybody. Take care. You're listening to us on 100.5 FM, Vancouver Co-op Radio, and we play all our shows at talkrecoveryradio.com. Have a great day, everyone. Bye.
Bye, you guys.
Bye-bye.